Hi, I'm Pete Hill, and this is the D-Word podcast, where we talk dementia. Welcome along to another podcast. I first came across this week's guest, Dr. Zoe Lewcock, on LinkedIn and was fascinated by her work on behaviour in ageing. It also introduced me to a term I was unfamiliar with, behavioural gerontology.
And you know what? Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's not a topic that most people have heard of or know anything about. So you are not alone in that. So behavioural gerontology is a subsection of a science called behavior analysis. So this is the science of human behavior. So a behavior analyst, which is what I am, behavior analysts are experts in human behavior and behavior change. So specifically how we can change behavior to make people's lives better. So behavioral gerontology specifically looks at how we use that science to best support older people, whether that be in supporting them with their healthcare needs, with preventing health issues, with maybe mental health issues like depression, anxiety. And obviously my area of kind of interest is working with older adults who have dementia. And I tend to get most frequently called to support with people who have dementia who are having some form of behavioral challenge, shall we say, kind of showing some form of distress behavior. Although that's not all we support with, we do a lot of work in increasing people's independence and reteaching lost skills or maintaining their skills long term. So that's kind of the two sides to what we do.
And in terms of behaviors, when you just looking at me or looking at you, complicated study in terms of dealing with people living with dementia, a very, very complicated study, I would guess.
It really is. And I think dementia is, I personally find it so fascinating, but obviously it's also devastating to the many people living with dementia. For me, I find it absolutely really, really fascinating, really interesting, knowing how human behavior works, how we all behave at every moment. All behavior is a form of communication, essentially. It's always to get something for ourselves, some kind of change in the environment. We're very receptive to what the environment does and how that influences us. But to then overlay onto that a condition like dementia that does affect how you perceive what's around you, how you interact with your environment and how you interpret what goes on, it can mean that our analyses and our investigations when we're called in to support can be really complex. They can be really in depth to get to the nitty-gritty and exactly what's going on for this individual person in this individual situation, with what's happening with them and how we can change that to better support them. Our work isn't actually one-on-one with the person with dementia. We run our analyses and our assessments with them, but actually the vast majority of our work is training carers. It's about how they can change their behavior. And as a behavioral analyst, I'm looking at how I can effectively change their behavior to then change the behavior of the person with dementia. So it's kind of like a two-step process. Okay, what does this person need to better support them? Now, how do I change that? Okay, how do I change the person that can change that? How do I change their behavior? So it gets complicated, but that's one of the kind of areas that I'm really passionate about, is figuring out how we can best support carers. And carers have a hard job, a really, really hard job. So figuring out how we can make training, to best support them, that it's effective and gives them the kind of skills to feel really competent and confident in what they do.
Yeah, and I guess you know, because everyone is different, that makes it, even more complex. And I guess if you're dealing with care workers who are in a residential setting, then, whether one person's behaviour, whether they're living with dementia or not, can be so, so different. I mean, how do you go about sort of influencing a care worker who perhaps has a finite amount of time to deal with a resident, and also they're not you know, all the residents are not living with dementia.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. So that's one of the kind of hallmarks of the work that we do, is everybody is a completely unique individual. Their behaviour is influenced by unique factors that are just for them. And that's why I struggle sometimes. People will be like, oh, you're an expert in dementia and behaviour. What do I do when a client does this? And my answer is, I have no idea. Because I don't know that person. I haven't looked at them. I haven't done observations. I haven't done analyses. How you would respond to one person with dementia who's doing this behaviour and another person with dementia who's doing the exact same behaviour will be completely different, because their life history, their perception of the world around them and what's going on for them will be different because they're unique individuals. So everything that we do is really about understanding the principles behind human behaviour and applying it on a case-by-case basis. In regards to the carers, you are right, that is the hardest part of my job. A lot of the time, actually figuring out what the person needs to better support them to change those behaviours is the easier part of my job. Then changing carer behaviour is the hard part. And like you say, when carers are really busy and they are rushed off their feet with not much to do and someone else has called in sick today, so they're short-staffed, all of these factors make it so hard. Some of the things that we look to do is almost these kind of small wins and ways to minimize the amount of time that they need to put in, but maximize the benefit for clients. So one of the examples that I really like was something that my colleague did, was all she did is simply change the furniture around in they were working in a hospital ward. And you know how quite often you see the chairs around the outside of the room, all facing in? All she did was change the chairs so that they were clustered in small groups around tables and activities. And she did this as a part a piece of research. She actually measured how much people were engaged with each other, and how much they were talking to each other and how much they were engaging in activities. And just by changing the furniture around, suddenly everyone started talking to each other more and doing activities. And it didn't require anything from the staff. The staff had nothing. They did not need to do anything or remember anything. And I think things like that are sometimes the most impactful. And it also means that if people are more engaged with each other and they're talking and they're doing, they are actually less likely to engage in distress behaviours for certain reasons, because they're not engaged. And that means that staff can then spend their time, that time that they've saved, managing those, dealing with those behaviours, on actually doing other things for the clients that improve their quality of life and supporting them on their behaviour plans.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
This is the D Word podcast, and I'm talking behavioural gerontology with my guest, Dr. Zoe Lugock. Do you think people tend to overcomplicate a lot of this in terms of trying to change behaviour?
Do you know what? I think we do. And I think part of it is that when you're in it, you can't see the wood for the trees, right? When you're a carer, it is so difficult to take an objective look. The amount of times I've worked with clients and caregivers, and they say to me, I can't believe how simple that is. I cannot believe you recommended this. And I thought, no way, that's so simple. And it's so obvious and it worked. And why didn't I think of that? And I think sometimes it's really not rocket science, but it does take a kind of very systematic, logical, objective look at what's going on to see those patterns that are emerging, to be able to then figure out what we can do about that. I think we do tend to look for something a lot more complex, and we sometimes miss the obvious solutions that are right in front of us.
And I guess, you know, you need a very good knowledge of the person that you're dealing with, and also their environment.
Absolutely. And I think this is where behavior analysts work really well. So we do a lot of work learning about the person, but we also we always observe what's going on. So I will always go to wherever that person is. I don't have a clinic. I don't work out of a hospital or anything like that. If that person is engaging in certain behaviours at home, I go home. If they're at the hospital, I go to the hospital. If they're in a care home, I go to the care home. It's about looking at their environment. And I will run very detailed environmental assessments to see what is going on with their environment. And, you know, the same goes for staff as well. So we're looking at some training for staff that we've devised that has come out of observations of staff. We are looking at the staff's behaviour and what in their environment is influencing their behaviour as well, and how we can change those aspects, and how we can empower the staff with the skills to proactively prevent distress behaviours with the people that they are caring for.
And, you know, when we talk about difficult or distressed behaviours, I guess that, you know, the normal human reaction, just, you know, even thinking about the children or something like that, is, well, don't do it. That's almost a reflex, isn't it? You know, I didn't like that, so don't do it. But, you know, that's really not the way to go, is it?
You're exactly right. That's something that's really, really crucial for us, is looking at positive ways to change behavior. And I always get when people speak to me, or when I'm talking about what I do, the focus always ends up being on distress behaviors, because that's kind of where people want us to come in and support with. But really, all behavior is reasonable, because it's there to support that person. I actually prefer the term behavioral expressions of unmet needs. It's a bit of a mouthful, but I think it shows what we mean a lot better. But yeah, I think responding, I have never advised anyone to respond to somebody by saying, no, don't do that, or that's wrong, or you're wrong, or any of those, because we know just from science, from the research, we know that doesn't work. And from a human element, it makes us feel better in the moment to respond that way, because it releases that frustration and that feeling of desperation that we just want it to stop. But actually, when we look at whether it works to change behavior, it doesn't. It really doesn't. So we're always looking for ways to meet people's needs ahead of time, so they don't actually need to ever engage in any form of behavior that is difficult, that's distressing for them, and maybe difficult for us to manage. So it's kind of a proactive method of really positive changes to their life, improving their quality of life, improving their ability to get their needs met, so that they don't need to engage in those behaviors, or we don't need to snap and get frustrated in the process.
And I guess it's kind of turning the coin on the other side, isn't it? Instead of, you know, looking at what makes someone agitated or annoyed, it's actually what makes someone content.
Absolutely. And like I say, I think there is so much of a focus on that side, the kind of distress behaviors, the challenging behavior, all of those terms that people use, and not enough focus on, well, how can we actually prevent this happening in the first place? What can we do to improve this person's life? What behaviors would they be able to engage in if their environment around them actually enabled them to? One of the things that I see really frequently is when someone goes into a care home, moves into a care facility, they lose skills quite quickly. And I think one of the reasons for that is that they're not practicing those skills. We all actually have to keep doing skills to maintain them. So even little things like making your own cup of tea, if you go into a care home, the vast majority of the time someone will make your tea for you. So it means that you aren't actually practicing those skills, and you might not even be practicing the skills of recognizing that you're thirsty and saying to somebody, I want a cup of tea, because actually someone just brings you one on a schedule or asks you every so often because that's what they have to do to fill out their cash. And I'm not saying that that's wrong necessarily, but what I'm saying is that isn't an environment that necessarily supports the maintenance of skills, that supports someone to keep those skills for a long time. So that's one of the ways that we look at things. And like I say, that's one of the things that we're really keen on teaching staff at the moment. We're kind of doing some work across Wales about training up staff in these skills, so that staff can recognise ahead of time how they are maybe accidentally or inadvertently over-caring, over-supporting somebody, how they might inadvertently be not encouraging independence and promoting someone to become reliant on support when actually they might be able to maintain that skill for a bit longer. And I think training up staff in that way is one of the best things that we can do to support the clients or people with dementia on a broader scale, because then you don't need people like me as often. Because if staff are already doing this, then people are already being supported in a way that keeps them active, engaged for longer, that maintains their skills for longer, that keeps them social and meeting those social needs more effectively. All of those things we know are really, really valuable in preventing distress behaviours. So I always say my ultimate goal is to actually work myself out of a job.
I'm sure there'll always be a place for you, Zoe. You know, one of the things, I totally agree with what you said. From personal experience with a family member, actually moving into some form of residential care, the residential care may be a beautiful environment, everything may be fine, but, you know, it can be one of the loneliest places in the world as well.
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot to be said for creating really incidental activities and hobbies and things to do. One of the things that I think is, if I have a day off and I'm just at home, I don't spend it doing arts and crafts and scheduled activities. I spend it pottering and getting jobs done and feeling productive and seeing people. And I think that is what we need to create for the people that we support. It needs to be about creating a life that's filled with purpose and meaning, not just about a very pretty environment where, yes, all your basic needs are met, your food and intake and you are clean, all of those are met. But actually, I think those human elements are much more, for me at least, as a behavior analyst, they're really important to behavior. They're what really matter for your quality of life, in that you need to be supported in a way that you feel empowered, you feel like you matter, because you do. You feel like you still have meaning and you are still important to people, and you're still having that connection with other people around you. So yeah, I agree. Sometimes I go into absolutely beautiful care homes and they are like living in a hotel, and then I think, do I want to live in a hotel? I probably don't, because I don't feel like I know anyone and it looks too clean and there's no clutter and what's there to do? Like, you get bored after a while. If you made me sit in a hotel for a whole day, actually I'd be pretty bored. One of the things that I always talk about is kind of good clutter. Obviously you want health and safety reasons. We need there to not be so much clutter that it's a danger, but clutter is really good for keeping people busy and engaged and starting conversations and, oh, there's something over there that's spilled. Let's get it. Let's tidy it up together. Not, oh, don't worry about it, I'll do it for you. Let's do it together and see what conversation comes from it, and have just a real natural engagement with somebody.
Do you think, you know, I don't know the answer to my own question here, but in terms of regulation of care facilities, obviously you've got to look at health and safety, you've got to look at environment, you look at food, etc. But I often feel all these social elements that we're talking about kind of sometimes get missed off the sheet a little bit.
100%. And I think it's because it's easy to document, not easy, but as in it's very simple to design a sheet that to track someone's fluid intake and to track their bowel movement and to even track where they are during the day. But actually tracking the quality of social interactions or the frequency with which they get to speak to people, the number of different people they get to speak to, the types of activities and engagements that they're getting throughout the day, that's really difficult to track, right? And also it's difficult as well to spend your whole day, we don't want carers to spend their whole day tracking and not actually doing. But I think when you've got, and we know that carers are often massively overloaded, they have so much to do in so little time. When you've got those things that need to be done, definitely, legally, these things need to be done. The things that are going to be lost first are the things that don't need to be tracked, that don't need to legally be done, and that aren't easy to evidence. If I have given someone a glass of water or a cup of tea, it is easy to evidence that. If I have spent 20 minutes having a really good, deep conversation that person's liked, It's not quite as easy to show what I've spent my time doing. So I think that there is something to be said about changing the culture in our system around what matters in care and what it means to be a carer.
Yeah, and I think it kind of sounds to me to be a little bit controversial about the whole thing, that the people that are actually inspecting, reporting, call it what you want, they're the ones that need some training in terms of, you know, the kind of stuff that you're doing. I worked for the Alzheimer's Society for a couple of years, and we ran 6 activity groups for people living with dementia in the community every week. And we had an audit, and coming round the audit, they were asking about paper trails and why haven't you put this poster on the wall and is that book available? And I kind of stood there and said, well, actually, over there is Alice. Alice loves the band and Dave Clark 5. She used to go to the Tottenham Royal Dance Hall. Over there is H. He was an Xboxer, lived in Kentish Town. And they kind of looked at me and said, well, yeah, now have you got that poster on the wall? And I was, you know, it's really frustrating for kind of staff working in that kind of environment.
It really is. I think it's not fair. I'm not saying anything that I don't think anyone listening will disagree with when I say that the care industry needs a massive overhaul. I think it needs shaking up. I think there's lots of changes that we need. And lots of money, right? It at the end of the day, it often comes down to money to be able to change the whole culture of the system, whole way that it's set up, and to inject more people in so that more can be done. So, okay, if we need a poster, we've got someone who deals with the posters and the making sure all of that stuff is set up. But actually, our people that are meant to be there working with the people one-on-one and creating meaningful change and meaningful day-to-day life for that person, they're the ones that can focus on that without worrying whether there's a poster in the right place.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
This is the D Word podcast with my guest, Dr. Zoe Lugock. I mean, behavioural analysis supervision. I suppose it'd be a little bit behavioural, the behaviour of the staff that are being supervised. We don't like being supervised, do we? We don't, you know, you don't like somebody staring over your shoulder. I mean, what's the kind of reaction to you doing your supervision, as it were?
So that's a really good question, actually. And I think one of the things that we really try and do is, so like I said, because we're part of this broader science where we're just analysing human behaviour, we're just really fascinating. Wherever you can find humans behaving, you'll find behaviour analysts looking at stuff and seeing how they can help. There's a whole subsection that looks at staff management and how we can support staff and how we can improve staff behaviour. That is a whole different area of our field. But we use some of the techniques and the understanding from that field or from that subspecialty in what we do. So whilst I'm kind of trained in dementia, I also look to bringing those techniques to support the care staff. So one of the first things that we always do is develop the relationship with them, because absolutely, like you say, nobody wants to be supervised. Nobody wants you to come in and watch them and tell them all the things that they're doing wrong. And one of the first things that I always try to make a point of doing is I'll go in and tell them all the things they're doing right. And that's for care staff and often for family members as well. In fact, I spoke to a family member just a couple of days ago who I've been working with and to support with managing their mum's behaviour. And I kind of just said, look, when I observed and you just did this and it was fantastic, I think it's absolutely brilliant what you did, it's spot on, it's exactly what I'd recommend. And she was almost emotional with like, oh, thank you, that means so much. Like, you never know if you're doing it right or you're doing it wrong, so no one's told me that I'm doing things right, thank you. And it's such a small thing, but I think that can really help to to set us up on the right foot to then provide more more support and more guidance. Nobody wants a recommendation from me when they don't know who I am and I'm just another random professional that's come in and observe. Actually, they want it from someone that they like. I think that's really important, to be likable, to understand where they're coming from as well. Like, I have worked in care. I know how hard it is. I know how exhausting it is. And I know how desperate you can feel on some days when you just, it's just not going right and everything's frustrated. I think that's a huge part of what we can do is really connecting with staff and working with them. And I think that's one of the things that we're quite keen on, is making sure that staff get time to speak to us as well. Not just we're telling them, but actually for them to come and mull things over with us and really get a chance to air their grievances almost and say, this is really hard. I don't understand why this is happening. What's going on? What can I even try and do? Because I feel like I've done everything. That's yet another area that I'm very, very keen on. And the same with this staff training that we're doing. One of the key aspects of it is that we get staff to actually go and look at and identify the barriers that they have to doing this, so that they can then come back and go, this is why I can't do it. My manager said this, or yeah, we wanted to do it, but there's no funding for this thing that's needed. Yeah, so identifying that, we ask them to identify barriers, like that their manager won't has said no, or health and safety reasons won't allow it, or there's no money in the pot for that. And actually figure out, or even just barriers like, I find it really hard because the other members of staff are judging me for doing it differently or doing it in a way that takes a little bit more time. And I think that can be one of the biggest, hardest parts, the biggest barriers or hurdles to overcome, is doing something that everyone else isn't doing, that you know is right, maybe theoretically, but maybe takes more time, or means that they have to do something else. Or that it's more effort, or it even makes them look bad. All of those cultural aspects are things that are really hard to change. But identifying them and figuring out that they're happening, I think, is the first step, so that we can then figure out how we can address them.
Yeah, I think we're looking at, you know, as you said earlier, a massive cultural change, which means you're certainly not going to do yourself out of a job, because there's going to be a lot wanted. I mean, it kind of reminds me, you know, I'm talking to friends and people living with dementia, and they always say to me, look, the first thing someone says to me, is they tell me what I can't do. Please tell me what I can do, not what I can't. And I think you've hit a new mantra there in terms of in judging someone's behaviour. Well, let's see what you did right first. And I think that's a great approach.
And I think that works both for the staff and for the clients that we support. It's, what are the staff doing well? What are the carers doing well? What is it that they're doing that is just wonderful? But the amount of times that I've walked away from an observation and I've said to them, you did this so well, I'm going to use this as an example of how to do this. And then also for our clients with dementia, one of the first things that I will do is figure out, what skills do they have? What is it that they can still do? What hasn't been lost yet? And even if it's something really simple, like looking in a certain direction or lifting their hand, it for somebody with maybe a more advanced dementia, there is still almost always something that person can do, and a way that we can use that to improve their quality of life. So yeah, I think that it's one of the reasons we I mean, I'm from positive aging consultancy and training, but the word positive in that was very much on that. It's about that additive, looking for what there is, looking for the positive, looking for what's available, whilst we're addressing something that can be seen as negative, the behavioural side of things, but we're doing it in a positive way. We're doing it in a way that builds on people's strengths and abilities.
Yeah, there's some good stories on your website blog. And, it, you know, there's one there in terms of getting a lady to shower more frequently. And some people may look at that and say, well, that's not great. But if you talk to a carer, that's a massive win, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think we underestimate the impact that behavioural issues have. And I think, in fact, just recently I spoke to a carer who said to me that nobody until she was saying to me, no one until you came along, no one cared. If we were having a problem with a behavioral issue, nobody cared about that. They just tell me to go to my GP, and my GP would refer me to the memory assessment service, and then they'd prescribe more medication or do a medication review. Once that was done, they'd come back to the GP, who'd then dismiss. That would be it. There's no help out there for, okay, but do you know what? I just need them to get dressed in the morning, and it's turning into a two-hour battle. How distressing is that for the carer as well as the person with dementia? And I think it's the buildup of those that often lead to people needing to be to going to care, because the carers are just so burnt out. One of my colleague's proudest moments, I think, is she worked with a client who was due to go into respite, which then turned into, actually, I think they're going to be staying there long term, because this lady just couldn't support her husband at home. And my colleague came in and she ran some assessments, and she looked at ways to prevent this behavior at home, and taught the wife how to do it, was there with her, coaching her along the way, taught her how to do it. She implemented it. It worked really well. And then she turned around and said, yeah, I don't want him in respite anymore. He doesn't need to go there. I can support him at home. And I just think, how much better would people's lives be if we had this available so that people could make use of this service and really develop their skills so that they can cope better. They don't have to go into this state of burnout. And it's simple things that can make a huge difference. And again, it all comes down to money. Think of how much money we could save with the placements. And so often we see clients who then come off antipsychotic medications, or they bring us in as a last resort before they go on antipsychotic medications to manage the behavior. And we're able to get people either off them or prevent them from needing to go on them to manage that behavior, just because we've changed the way that they're supported and the way their carers are empowered to care for them.
Well, unfortunately, Zoe, my behaviour is looking towards the clock because we're running out of time, but it's been absolutely fascinating. And hopefully we can get you back on the show in maybe 6 months and talk some more. Thanks so much for introducing me, certainly, I'm sure the listeners, to a whole branch there in behavioural gerontology that a few minutes ago we didn't know anything about. We know a little bit now. And thank you for doing such a good job.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And this has been a real privilege. So thank you so much.
Hope you found that as fascinating as I did. Thanks to Zoe for joining me here on the podcast. And if it sparked your interest, you can find out more at positiveagingconsultancy.co.uk. Well, that's all for this edition. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me again soon here on the D Word Podcast.